Robin Ayew from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another conversation, to another episode. Today, as we were saying just before we started the press record button here, I'm in the presence of greatness. We have three individuals who appeared individually on the podcast, and we've talked about a very interesting topic, cybersecurity in the cognitive sense. And I thought we'd bring all together the four of us and discuss this topic at length. From my perspective and from the perspective of the audience, I want to just first, let's do a bit of an introduction just for those who did not see the previous episodes, just to make sure that everybody knows who is on the screen with me today. We'll start with Len, then we'll go to Mike, and then we'll go to Wynn. Len, if you don't mind, the floor is yours.
Absolutely. My name is Len No. I am a divergent research engineer, and my claim to fame is I am the world's first augmented ethical hacker. I have currently 11 different implanted pieces of technology that I have implanted in my body between my elbows and my fingertips for the purposes of cybersecurity. And I've been a former black hat cyber criminal and 1%er outlaw motorcycle gang member. And I personally feel that I am the epitome of it takes a thief to catch a thief. And I'm very happy to see you again, Robin.
Happy to see you as well, Len. Thanks for joining us. Mike, if you don't mind.
Yeah, Robin, good to see you again. And Mr. Len and Mr. Wynn, namaste. Great to be here. Mike Elkins, Chief Human and Information Security Officer at Humanis Technologies. Humanis Technologies is a company that is focused on three pillars: risk management, cybersecurity, and resiliency. I've been a practitioner for nearly 28 years in the world of technology, wore just about every hat you can imagine, from governance, risk, and compliance to infrastructure, architecture, software development, R&D. And as I released on the last conversation we had, Robin, I also co-developed a staff duress badge for a large healthcare provider in the Philly area. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Mike, for joining us. Appreciate it. Wynn, good to see you again, if you don't mind, for those who don't know you.
Recovering analog recording engineer and producer.
We're not worried.
Everybody's doing this. I feel like I have to do the same, I guess.
Fell into security in 83 and been doing it ever since. Big shift, though, in 2016, and discovered or found or think that cybersecurity, biological security, and cognitive security are all different ways of looking at the same thing from different prisms. And so with these guys trying to, they keep me in line on the guardrails from getting too far out there.
We appreciate it, Wynn. Thanks for joining us.
I've never been referred to as a guardrail before, Wynn. I don't know how to take that.
is a LobbyCon discussion.
True that.
Absolutely. So I want to begin with a question for the three of you, if you don't mind. When we spoke individually, each of you touched, and I guess when I first started the conversation on this topic, I started with Wynn, who is the one who brought up the idea of the human brain has become the most valuable attack surface in the cyberspace. And we individually spoke about this one-on-one with each of you, but do you think right now the world fully understand the shift yet? And why is it so important for people to understand that? If you don't mind, we'll start with the one who started it all. We'll start with Wynn, and then we'll go to Mike, then Len.
Industry doesn't get it. I mean, keep in mind that neuroscience is fundamentally maybe 30 years old. And we've had behavioral psychology. We've had various aspects of sort of what makes us tick as humans, the philosophical aspects of it. But in terms of taking a serious look at the operations, the behavioral influences, the types of defenses or resiliencies that are needed in human cognition in this machine up here, we're really only getting started. Even amongst ourselves, we may think we know what we're talking about, but we're all learning. And the biggest difference that occurs in this space, in my opinion, compared to what happened 35, 40 years ago, is that this is infinitely more interdisciplinary. None of us are going to be able to do it on our own.
Absolutely. And Mike, what's your take on that?
Yeah, so Wynn is accurate with what he shared. And I'll say, you know, I've really been getting deep into the cognitive security world really only in the past like 3 years or so, working with Wynn and Len and some folks over at the Cognitive Security Institute. You know, I started in tech 28 years ago, and if you would have told me how interdisciplinary I would have had to have been to rise through the ranks and accomplish all the things that I was able to accomplish, I would have thought you were full of crap, right? I mean, it's ones and zeros, and it's technology, you study technology, but we're finding that we have to tremendously now branch out and study things like cognitive security, like human agency, like neuroscience, even neurobrain chemistry and how we can modulate things like dopamine and oxytocin. And all those things come into play from a human perspective on how we live our lives. But those are all things that the attackers are fully exploiting to their advantage, right? They're using textbooks, college psychology to poison the minds of humans, as well as the AI machines. And it's a really interesting field. One of the reasons why I love it so much is because it is so interdisciplinary. I've been fortunate enough to really branch out and be able to network with academia professors who are cyber psychologists or people who are focused in the actual like psychology, like clinical social workers and folks like that, and hearing all those different perspectives and the range of those perspectives, knowing that a lot of the clinical psychologists and cyber psychologists are saying, you know, we need to start kids in terms of security awareness training as young as 6 years old because of the exposure that they get. And, you know, I look around, I go to a restaurant and I just see kids staring at tablets and phones this close to their face. Why? Mom and dad, rightfully so, are just trying to have a drink and get 5 minutes of peace in their life. And we don't really know the impact of just staring at a rectangle all day and what data is being kind of pushed into the brain of the person on the receiving end.
Absolutely. And I know when we did the conversation with Len, he spoke about his own personal experience with this. He mentioned to me during the recording that he had two kids, God bless them.
Grandkids.
One is on no tablets, no connectivity, and the other person was. And I let him explain what he saw in that experiment. It's pretty interesting to see it.
Well, before I get into the explaining the example, I want to take you the original question that you asked, Robin. You know, is everybody aware? And to me, the obvious answer is no, because realistically, if we just take a look at what's going on just around the proliferation of personally identifiable information and personally identifiable behaviors that we are just giving up through the use of things like social media, or just look at the fact that social engineering, which has been one of the key elements to most cybersecurity or offensive security attacks, this has been going on since the beginning. We used to call it scams. We used to call it fraud. And to quote Kevin Mitnick in the title of his book, the weakest link in any security chain will always be the human element. But to give you the explanation of the answer, I have two grandchildren. One of them has been raised with a screen in front of her face since the time she was 3 months old. The other one has had essentially no screen time whatsoever. One has been raised according to what most people would consider a normal child's upbringing in 2025, 2026. And the other one is basically living a life right out of Little House on the Prairie. One of them, you know, she can actually go out. She has responsibilities. She does chores, takes care of livestock. And she's okay if we stick her in a room with nothing else and she can self-soothe and she can be okay. The other one, if you take away her phone, she has a complete emotional breakdown. One of them may be better suited to survive in the world that we're living in, but the other one can actually survive in the world as an individual. And to be honest, I don't know which one is more prepared. I think they both have positives and negatives, but sitting out watching their development has been a real exercise in what the future is going to give to the next couple of generations.
Absolutely. And, you know, every time I remember this story, which I've been, you know, since we spoke, Len, it's been in my mind. You know, that's quite the opposite, if you will, in the same household, in the same family almost, to have those two different, you know, opposite end sort of an experiences with a exposure time to information versus no exposure times. So it's quite fascinating, actually, to see that. And you can see it nowadays, I mean, everywhere. Kids nowadays walking around and you see accidents reported in the news every day. So they're putting their phone down, gets hit by a car. And those things are happening, not necessarily because of anything else, just because of the addiction to, somebody mentioned it earlier. I think Mike mentioned it earlier, like the connection between that whole excitement you get from clicks, likes, etc. And people get attracted to it. Now,
and that's by design, Robin.
Absolutely.
I forget the exact title of the book, but there's a book that's effectively the Silicon Valley playbook. And it effectively says that in order to have a successful product, it must be addictive, right? And scrolling through whatever your social media app, the reason why you're scrolling up and down. That is a very analogous to self-stimulation, right? If you were to self-stimulate, it's that scrolling up and down and the constant release of dopamine, it becomes such an addiction to so many people. I mean, just look at the average statistics of how much time people spend on their phone, let alone watching television. It's something like 6 to 13 hours per day, just staring at a rectangle, getting those dopamine hits all the way up till they crash. They wake up the next morning, right back on the dopamine hit. And it, you know, that has widespread impacts into all the other aspects of personal and professional life.
And we don't have enough data. Sorry, then go ahead.
Just one thing that I wanted to throw at as an add-on to what Mike just said, I think we're starting to actually see the ramifications of that. I mean, if you take a look at the trial that's going on right now with Meta and whether or not they were actually using practices that took actually target and addict younger children, and that's actually going through the courts right now. And I would love to hear Wynn's thoughts on that. I really would.
Okay, Wynn, off to you.
I did a bunch of research on this before my Meta War book came out, and I was actually really astounded that in public forums, the various senior executives at Meta, including Zuckerberg, made some statements that support exactly what is going on, what is happening in the trial, and controversy. It increases the number of people that come by and hang around and argue, and that more attention is spent there, therefore we're going to make more money. That theme has been very public on their part. This is nothing that's hidden. I mean, I did all this through open source work, and I was astounded. And can you imagine if you had a patent right now, and you said, "And this is a cool blue blinky light thing that's going to transform your life, but it's also going to be highly addictive." Would, under that phrasing, that framework, would we allow that to go out into the public? Would we allow cigarettes, for example, to go to the public today under what we know? Well, somehow, for whatever reasons, without going down those roads, the entire big tech industry recognizes something that we've known for a couple hundred years, and it's called the attention economy. And that is what's driving everything right now, regardless of what it takes to capture your attention. Big tech's going to do it because it's money.
I see. There's an economy around that, right?
That's the whole thing. It's the attention economy, which is a book from a few years ago as well. And Mike, I do forget the name of that book that you're talking about, The Bible. It was published in 2014, and it's got a yellow cover with black words on it. And it's one of those books you've got to read because it's mind-blowing, and I reference it a fair amount. No, that's my book. That's not the yellow book.
The yellow book.
And I forget the name of it.
So while you're on the microphone there, when you were last on the show, you spoke about the evolution of cyber warfare beyond infrastructure into information domain. Did anything change since then, or would you like to give us an update on the topic?
It got worse.
Go with them.
Who wants to take that on then? Len, do you want to take that on?
The evolution of cognitive warfare, one could argue, goes back to the beginning of civilization when the hunter-gatherer of groups of 50 to 150, which is an optimal size for a group for self-sustenance, evolved into the agrarian society, and then organization was required. As soon as you have organization, then you have hierarchy. Then you've got the issue of power, who's in control, and this goes back 8,000 years. So fast forwarding even more, the Egyptians in the Pharaonic dynasties knew well what it took to control a population in order to build stuff, irrigate, be able to feed, in that case, even several million people. Fast forward, I'll go to Machiavelli, control the people's minds, bam, done. You go to Tsarist Russia, exactly the same thing. Now, in more modern times, you go to the late 1800s, and that was exactly the model used by the predecessors to the KGB under the former Tsarist methodologies of controlling a population before the revolution. Go to the 1930s. What happened to an entire population? And these are what I call, and these guys know I'm working on this, is cognitive Pearl Harbors, events that are so seismic to your mind that your sense of identity and agency you have effectively given up to others unknowingly.
Len?
End of rant.
Yep. I I have watched, especially with the advent of artificial intelligence, being the victim of a deepfake scam myself. You asked, is it the same or has it gotten worse? I have been doing a lot of current research just around the concepts of deepfakes and sexually explicit deepfakes. We've seen all of the kind of things that have happened as a result of the leniency that certain AI models... Excuse me. Didn't mean to... I hate it when that happens.
That's all right. We can edit that out. Don't worry, Lynn.
Oh, no, that was the whole point. Leave it in. You know, I've looked at this more from a really fundamental level. You know, I think all of us here on this panel, I'm going to be a little couth, if I may, for just a moment. I think we're all probably over the age of about 30.
Not me.
You're very generous.
When you're
going down in age, not up.
When you're timeless, it's okay. You know, and we can all say, and I can think we could all very, very positively agree on the fact that one of the greatest things about being born when we were, it's not that we didn't do stupid things. They just don't live in perpetuity on the internet somewhere. So when we look at what we grew up with, when I watched the news as a child and I watched Dan Rather or Walter Cronkite give me the news, I knew that that was Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather. You know, if we wanted to have a fake of somebody, I remember, you know, the old Richard Nixon plastic masks that people use during robberies. And it was very obvious that this is not a real human being. But, you know, one of the things that I've really keyed in on, especially since getting, you know, in touch with Wynn around Meta War and the Cognitive Security Institute, is what does the environment that we're actually raising children in today, what does that do to their natural development? You know, we had the ability to ground our basic facts of life in some form of solid reality. You know, black was black, white was white, green was green. This person was this person. Now we are living in a world where an entire generation from this point forward is going to grow up with having to completely redefine what is truth and what is real. You know, and so you ask if it's getting better or worse. As the continual technologies increase, I feel that our ability for individualism and honestly, individual sovereignty continues to decrease. So that's my response.
Thank you, Len. I really appreciate it. Mike, what's your take on all this?
Yeah, so obviously plus one to what both these legends have said. I'll take a slightly different but similar route. Think of when we talk about cognitive Pearl Harbor, how many folks do you know that will read something online and just take it for gospel, regardless of what it is, regardless of what the source is.
It must be true.
Exactly, right? And at least, you know, going back to Len's analogy of us being about 150 years old, we grew up in a world where we had at least a partial break from all the technology, right? And then when we started getting into it, it was like 56K dial-up, where a half of a hand would take 30 minutes to load. And you're like, okay, I think it's a hand at the end. Now we live in a world where everything is so instant, so rapid, and people don't have that ability to step back and look at it and try to figure out what are the biases, what are the facts, where the sources could come from. They take it for gospel, and then they regurgitate it onto their own platforms and their own meetings without doing any sort of due diligence. On top of that, I think there's certainly an aspect of it's always been this way. I think this is just human nature, right? When eloquently states that, you know, we build AI in our image. Do we like what we see? And, you know, it's very true. A lot of what we see in the challenges are just, these are human nature. I don't even want to call them challenges. It's just human nature behaviors, right? As humans, we fight, we have wars, we have deception. There's a lot that goes on, and this has been going on since the history of time. Where I think things are slightly different to Len's point is the scale and the speed at what's the disinformation and digital debauchery is happening. And then because people are not kind of taking a step back, self-removing, trying to look at things with an objective point of view, that leads into the more manipulation. And the last thing I'll throw out there is, especially with artificial intelligence and, you know, all these democratized hacking tools that are out there for anybody to use, nation state adversaries to a 14-year-old kid with an iPhone that just wants to burn the world down, there's hyper-personalized attacks, right? Where these AI systems are creating a Robin attack profile that knows more about Robin than Robin knows, that will feed you and ingest information into your feeds, into your dialogue, into your world that is very specific to Robin, that they'll do it for Len, then they'll do it for Wynn and for me and XYZ. And that adds to more of that, oh, this, it's on the internet, it must be true, because it feels so personalized to us as individuals with the phishing emails or the financial fraud or, you know, grandma's emptying out her bank account. All these things happen because people feel some personal connection, some level of trust, or some level of something with somebody that they never met that lives in the digital world that may or may not even be accurate. And I go back to the story where the one woman like lost $850,000 to a Brad Pitt deepfake scam. And it's like, you really think Brad Pitt's going to be calling you? He's got plenty of money. But this woman wound up like sending her entire life savings to some, you know, digital twin of Brad Pitt that was just for fraud. And the last thing I'll say to that, a lot of what happens when people underreport those kind of events, those massive frauds, those hyper-personalized attacks, and again, this comes down to the human element, fear, shame, and embarrassment are the three things that prevent people from actually sharing some of this information so we can get accurate statistics, or, you know, they won't even tell their own family members that they just lost their house because, you know, of a financial fraud event because of a hyper-personalized digital attack.
You know, one of the questions I had, and then you started on the, down the road, Mike, in your answer is, are we entering into a period where, and I think, you know, you guys would agree on this one, but I'd like to explore it a little bit with you, is the machine at some point is more understanding now of a human psychology than we do as a human understanding our own psychology. I feel like, you know, the programs that we're, you know, we're engaging with, the software that we're engaging with, the social media interactions that we're having, it sounds to me, and I, you know, you mentioned, you know, phishing emails, like I feel like it's, you know, part-time job for me is just to delete emails that they're trying to get something from me. But the question here becomes is, if you know that there is tools out there, and there are many of them, that understands us better than we understand ourselves, that makes us a lot more vulnerable, because the idea is, that must be true because, you know, they understand what I'm going through. They understand my sadness, my happiness, my fears, my whatever they are. My, you know, I'm looking for opportunities, and all of a sudden, the phone and the email start, you know, ringing, and I fake opportunities, obviously. It's a great deal of misinformation there.
Robin, it sounds like you're getting ready to marry your chat buddy.
I know. Sounds like, yeah.
Somebody's got a new...
What you're talking about, Robin, is... I'm a big fan of OODA loops, all systems in the universe, whether it's spiral galaxies or it's us or it's a cyber system, any system at all, it has one goal only, and that is to survive, which means that the OODA loop has to continue. Interrupting that OODA loop at any point is the only way that humanity is going to be able to escape being taken over by technology. And understanding the, and I'm using the word mechanics here very loosely, but understanding the system processes. And as you said, you know, take a pause. Yes, the only way to do this is to take a pause. And the term I'm using for it now with another upcoming book, here comes the plug, of course, critical ignoring, which means that we have to, as a species, get our bullshit meters really, really well tuned. Back when we were 50,000 years ago, we would smell the water to tell if it was any good or not. Oh, don't drink it. It smells like crap. Don't eat that leaf, because our survival mechanisms with the environment, we adapted to it very, very well. We have not adapted as a species to the information-based environment. If we don't, we lose.
And I love the BS meter, though. I love the BS meter. I'm just imagining in my mind like a social media post with a BS meter on it.
I'm not building any more companies or products, so don't look for me for that.
When for the first cognitive security conference, the badge needs to be a bullshit meter. That's right there. That's the badge.
Mike, CSI Vegas.
I think that's a good conversation we'll have on Monday.
Thank you, Len.
You're welcome. But the one thing I want to key in on both your last statement, Wynn, and Robin's, is we keep talking about the machine as if it's sentient and that is the adversary. It's not necessarily the technology. It's the people that are owning the technology. You know, it's not ChatGPT, it's Sam Altman and his board of directors, and it's his shareholders. It's not Meta, it's Zuckerberg and the shareholders. You know, at the end of the day, these machines, whatever biases they have, be they positive or negative, these are all at the whims of the people that own the code and own the machines. So at the end of the day, it's not the machines that we're fighting. It's the people that are actually controlling the machines.
I mean, you got to look at it from the standpoint, at least I do, you know, you don't have to, is human history is about storytelling, period. End of story. It's about the narrative in order to create a belief system, a buy-in system. And that narrative could be a deep fake, as Lynn's talking about. It could be the moon is made of green cheese. It could be any historical revisionism. Doesn't matter. The narrative is the only thing that matters. They who control the technology control the narrative. They who control the narrative control your beliefs. How do we fight that? And that is a lot of what the Cognitive Security Institute is about. That's a lot of our discussions at lobby cons when we're traveling around trying to find an inspiration, interdisciplinary inspiration to give us a crack to how do we battle this? I'm going back to my bullshit meter.
And we're battling basic human psychology and pack mentality. You know, if you have a large enough, to put Wynn's point, you know, remember when there was the deep fake of Elon Musk around Dogecoin? You know, everybody and their brother went out and started buying this garbage crypto because they thought some Elon was involved. Then it comes out, no, that was your
money
deepfake.
On Dogecoin. So, but I was listening to Mark Cuban, not Elon.
But my point is, it's just what Wynn said, control the narrative, control the people. And when we have individuals, and that leads more into a more of a psychological discussion. I remember when I was younger, I don't remember seeing influencers, because we didn't, you know, our influencers were people like John Glenn and, you know, titans of industry and things, but you know, they weren't coming out giving you their personal opinions about every issue that was coming out. They weren't trying to steer the general populace's, you know, direction. At most, I remember Reading is Fundamental and Schoolhouse Rock, you know, and everything was meant to be a general positive. It wasn't like Don Henley telling me which way I need to vote.
Yeah, that's a sense of false authority and a fallacy argument.
Absolutely. And nowadays, everybody wants that 15 minutes of fame. And once they get it, they feel like it's almost their obligation to vomit out their belief structure. I get asked all the time, what are my personal beliefs? And my answer every time is, they're personal.
Yeah, they're personal, absolutely.
Mine's different, Len. People say, what do you believe? And I say, I don't think at this point I believe anything.
I'm stealing that.
It's very difficult for me to say because that belief is the opposite of the scientific method.
I'm stealing that.
You have a pretty good bullshit detector.
Bullshit detector, which never reaches one. It's always the hybridization of all of these, whether it's the system one hyperreaction survival mechanism or the cogitative critical thinking system two. How do we get them to engage each other more is a lot of the discussions that we've all been having. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to take over from you, Mike. My apologies.
Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, so I'll take it a step further. I think a lot of what we're seeing today in the real world, I mean, look, the world's on fire in every corner of the world at this point, and it's been this way for a little bit, and my intuition makes me believe that, or gives me the intuition that things are going to continue to stay pretty kludgy and jacked up for the next probably 5 to 10 years. We'll see where it goes. Nobody can predict the future.
Three-piece. Do you know what the actual acronym SNAFU means?
No.
Systems normal, all fucked up.
Yeah.
Right. It's SNAFU right now.
Yeah. So we're certainly, you know, a lot of what we're seeing in the real world are things from science fiction 30 to 50 years ago, right? Artificial intelligence is not new. It's really smart software. It's been around for a long time. You know, the theories around quantum computing and deep fake and all this stuff has been around for quite some time. And we're really just starting to see more and more of it in the wild. And I try to forecast out, not just today, but for a child that is born in the year 2045, and they just come into the world in the year 2045, the moment they're birthed into the world, they have an electronic footprint with an electronic medical record. They've got all kinds of different things with federal, state, local, tribal things that kind of attach to that person. And everybody uses phones nowadays, right? But if you think in 20 years from now, you know, we're going to be using more AR, VR headsets. We're going to be using more the glasses. We're going to be using more brain implants. You don't think so?
No, it's going to be all internal at that point. You're not going to have external devices. You're going to be, you guys are going to start walking my road, and you're going to become augmented.
And when you look,
I did throw that out as the last one. I did say brain implants.
Mike, I don't know if you were there, but when we were at Hacker Summer Camp a couple of years ago, I was doing one of the whoever does the podcast. I forget his name, and it was like 2 weeks after Apple had come out with a patent for a new set of earbuds. With 38 different biosensors. Do you want Apple having your automatic high-speed emotional physiological reactions being fed back to their algorithm in order to know what to feed back to you to control your behavior? This is absolutely real. And whether it is going to be a plug into the ear or it's going to be somebody cutting me open like Len likes to do and have it all, we're not going to be wearing 2 pounds.
We're not going to be wearing anything. One last thing to throw in there. If you're not familiar with a gentleman by the name of Noland Arbaugh, I would really suggest that you look into him. He is actually Neuralink's patient one, and he is actually leading the charge right now for neural data privacy rights. You know, because it wasn't until after he had Neuralink's BCI put in that he really started thinking about it. Every bit of his bio data that is being recorded by that device is now currently the property of Elon Musk. So as we start looking into these newer technologies that are integrating more deeper systems into the human biology, we need to stop right here, draw the line in the sand. We have medical privacy laws, but there's nothing that actually is addressing what these sensors are actually receiving and how they're being used. So neural data privacy, I think, is the next frontier.
Well, don't forget, it's not really as loud as it should be. Columbia University runs the Neural Rights Foundation. So the other thing I want to point out, and these guys will hopefully agree, in the UK and EU, we'll look at those as one, even though my British friends wouldn't like that. But looking at that as one cultural ecosystem more than us, the governments have budgeted 150 billion euros to work on neuro rights and neurological defense, education, everything we're talking about. 150 billion euros over a period of 10 years. Robin, how much does the U.S. spend?
I know you mentioned that number, but it's very tiny. Zero.
Zero is a very tiny number, yes.
And
there's a reason for that, and I'm not going to go down it. Just use your own critical thinking to figure it out.
Consumerism.
That's only that's the advertising side of it. That's not even the big tech side of it. There's all the other societal implications of controlling the narrative.
So, you know, just hearing you talk about this topic, which is very, very interesting to me and on various levels. So are we entering into a, you know, so should we get like some sort of an advocacy group that says we're going to concentrate on unplugging people out of the system like they do in the Matrix? It sounds to me like that's the next sort of logical step. If we don't want to be part of a system that consumes our biology, our thoughts, our whatever, everything else, I guess, they've got access to. I think I call it
critical ignoring.
Critical ignoring, is that what you call
Everything is bullshit. Then it's go back to early cybersecurity days, and I'm going back to the late 70s, early 80s with mainframes.
Yeah.
There were two competing companies for mainframe security, IBM and Computer Associates.
That's right.
There were two different models that they used. One of them was connect everything. Everything is on. Anybody can do everything and then explicitly remove those rights. The other one was what we would now perhaps call today zero trust or something along that line. Nothing is connected. And in order for you to be able to do something, you had to be given explicit permission by a third party. We have missed that's exactly what's happening to us, which is why the bullshit meter and critical ignoring are, in my opinion, absolutely critical to getting people to behave. And this is about behavior, that everything I see may not be as it seems. What's behind the veil? We're all doing a conference called, what is it, OzCon?
OzCon.
And the promoters are doing a great job of what's behind the curtain. And that's exactly where we are today. When you see a headline, what's behind the curtain?
That's right.
What is behind that? What is the intention behind it? And intention and narrative. I am scared shitless of them. Can I say that on this?
Yeah, you can. Fine.
All right.
We're good. Yeah, we're good.
You know, Go ahead. I want to throw this question at Mike, because I know you've done a lot of research around this, and we both, I agree with everything that Wynn just said, but the one question that I keep coming back to is, let's use the Matrix as the analogy. How do you get the rest of the population to agree to unplug? You know, I've stood on stage, Wynn stood on stage, you've stood on stage. We preach this type of stuff from the pulpit, and we'll grab one or two here and there. But how do you convince somebody who is completely addicted to the psychological dopamine and serotonin to agree to walk away from their addiction?
That's a great question, Len. And we talk in lobby cons and chats and all the time about all kinds of stuff like this. Like, how can we scale the impact of what we're trying to do and bring more people along for the ride? Go back to just
how do we entice them to want it? You know, because if you remember that movie with Jennifer Aniston, and I forgot the dude from Dodgeball, when she was like, do you want to do the dishes? And he was like, why would I want to do the dishes? You know, how do we get them to where we can tell them everything that's wrong and all the damage it's going to do, but until they want to make those changes, how do we get them to want to make the change?
And that's, you know, it always comes down to that addiction 101, whatever you're addicted to, right? It's how do you, it starts internally, right? And most of that, if you look at Tony Robbins or more the psychology, it really starts with changing your identity. Right? If you are a smoker of cigarettes, you identify as a smoker. If people quit smoking, you'll hear their terminology change to, I'm not a smoker, right? So a lot of it starts with self-belief, self-individual action, and then the ability or desire to want to make a change. And humankind, from my understanding, there's only a couple of reasons why we make change, right? It's either we're so desperate, we don't have a freaking choice, or world circumstances have pushed us into a direction, right? Health, money, whatever the thing is. And that's how we start to take action and make some changes. But, you know, Wynn's been screaming about this stuff on the pulpit for almost as long as I've been alive. I'm joking, but for quite some time, right? And it's great that he's doing it. And he's published a lot of books to bring that knowledge. He speaks at, you know, 15 conferences a year as a keynote speaker all around the world. But we still don't have a big change. So I think as a community, not just the technologists, right? As a human species, we really need to figure out how far down this line we want to go. Obviously, it's a very individual decision. It's a Len's example of his grandkids, right? There, you can see two opposite ends of that spectrum. We don't know what's necessarily the right way or the wrong way or the good path or the bad path, but it really starts with the individual. So awareness is key. I think that's good. Training is key. But that can't be the only thing. There has to be something more.
And to Len's point, I've got my one grandson, and we are, I'm not saying it's right. All I'm saying is what we're doing, we're taking a very hybrid approach and taking an analog approach. It's reading time. All right. Those are books. It's mechanics time. You're allowed to watch, yeah, some screen time. What is it going to be? I want to watch Octonauts and learn about this. Okay, that's a hell of a lot better than Bugs Bunny, we'll say.
Nothing was better than Bugs.
No, and it's what we're trying to do is create a balance between the survival in both and the optimization, and realizing that a lot of the analog world is, that's how this functions. This is not digital, and we're trying to treat it as digital in so many areas. And I'm still looking for the name of that book that Mike referenced, and I'm going to find it before the end of this call. But hybridization is going to be part of it. And Len knows about hybridization better than any of us through the transhumanistic, is that the right, transhumanism efforts that he's doing. There's going to be hybridization.
You know, one of the things that comes to mind, which, you know, the legislative part of it, right? So you hear about GDPR and, you know, privacy, the private act, information for privacy, privacy information, like protecting the private information. I guess in the US they call it something, here they call it PIPDA or something like this.
HIPAA.
And so, yeah, so that's the idea here is, on with all these legislation in place, the proliferation of digital, like, it means nothing now to have a, you know, legislation in place. Hey, you should protect information ABC. Meanwhile, the information is available to everybody. I don't know what these laws are for, if that's the case.
Well, here in the United
States. Here it is. Here's the book.
You found it?
Yep, that's it.
Hooked, yes.
Yeah, listeners out there, if nothing else, go get the condensed version of it.
Yeah, the Cole's Notes version, huh?
It's scary. It's scary because those who control the money are controlling the technology, are controlling the narrative, are controlling your beliefs, and you're out of the loop. And when we look at the economic Gini scores of at least this country, it's out of control, completely out of control.
Yeah. Robin, you hit on something really important. And, you know, having been in the world of technology and looking at policy and law and look, I'm not a lawyer, but geez, my experience, I'm pretty much a JD at this point, and especially in privacy, right? Like, you know, I working for a $10 trillion company that had, you know, privacy challenges that would come from every corner of the country and the world, you know, a lot of times I was walking a floor or two down to sit with chief legal counsel and be like, hey, what's going on here? But the challenge is the laws and the policies are important. We cannot skirt that. But that process is so slow and the technology advances so fast that we get to a point that by the time a policy or a law comes into place, you know, real world circumstances have changed that law three times in the year it took for somebody to sign that into law. And we're always playing this catch up game. In a world of cyber and technology and narrative information warfare and deception, we're in this constant cat and mouse game with the adversaries, with the bad actors, whatever. And somehow, I don't know the answer yet, before I die and leave this planet, I will figure this out. I'm committed to that. But how do we get some sort of a quantum leap advantage to get ahead of the game so that we can stop playing catch up all the time, stop trying to, you know, reactively write all these policies and laws into play and try to get something that's a little more proactive and upfront? I'm not sure what that answer is, but we certainly need to do more in that
space. I'm glad you brought that up, because at LobbyCon, it's at the CSI conference in Tampa, I know that we had uneducated people like me, practitioners like you, then a bunch of really brilliant PhDs. And it was like, wow. So after a couple glasses of wine, we loosen up and throw out ideas. And Crystal, remember Crystal,
I do.
There was this PhD in psychology, and I don't want to give away too many on her details. She was talking about, you know, the study that you're referencing, I was referencing a Cambridge study that had been done on misinformation, disinformation. She goes, they did that all wrong. It should have been done this way and this way, and we'd have gotten different results. And I said, you have just volunteered for this project. She goes, what? I said, you're at LobbyCon. You don't know how this works, do you? And so I'm actually writing up a paper for her to say, take a look at how the OODA loops work. And how do you interrupt those OODA loops so that it becomes a natural process as we adapt for survival in a technological information-rich society? Is it going to work? I don't know. I'll probably die before Mike dies. You're going to have to let me know, Mike.
I'll connect with you on the other side. I'll let you know.
We've got the inner Ouija board. It's not the internet, but the inner Ouija. But I want to go back to the original question for just a second, Robin. You tried to compare the European Union's data privacy and GDPR to what we have here in the United States with HIPAA. They are nothing alike. The only similarity is that they're both somewhat related to health and medical privacy. One of the biggest differences, especially, you know, in terms of how we deal with things here in the US, all of our records, there is a record of my birth from back in 1974, and there is a medical record sitting somewhere of when I got my child immunizations, when I sprained my ankle, and every other medical trip I've ever made in my life. And there is nothing I can do about that, because if we look at this from a larger view, everything here in the United States is tied back to that individual file. You know, if you want to get insurance, they're going to check your credit rating. If you want to get life insurance, they're going to look at your medical history. One of the big advantages that Europe and GDPR provides is the right to refuse. The Vyman Plus, under the GDPR law, once a company is done utilizing my personal data, they have to get rid of it. It can't be shared. Whereas that is the basis of a lot of the consumerism in the United States. So, and you know, we talk about wanting legislation. Unfortunately, here in the U.S., the laws are actually in favor of maintaining records, because it's back to Wynn's point, the more information you have, the easier it is to manipulate the individual.
Yeah, the data becoming the currency and the product at the same time.
Absolutely. And we built our entire economy around that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, and there is no such thing as privacy. Let's be honest. I mean, as much as I would,
Scott McNeil,
as much as I would love to have it. Yeah, like it would be nice to have. It would be great to have some level of privacy. But look, I don't care what country you live in. You've got security cameras. You've got digital devices in your house. You carry around a digital device that's attached to you at the hip or at your wrist. You know, there's and 100%, 100%, I cannot stress that enough, 100% of everything you do in the digital world is monitored, tracked, logged on a database, is used to sell you something. Exactly, right? So I guess starting with that as a baseline, right? When you're 6 years old, and I don't know how you explain this to a six-year-old, probably through some good storytelling, but hey, you know, everything you do in the digital world, you're leaving breadcrumbs and trails.
Absolutely.
And something you do, you know, when you're 10 or 12 or 14, that maybe you're just being silly or stupid or you're goofing around with your friends, literally could impact your ability to become a senator or get a job.
Somebody
when
will
older.
Find it and flag it to you.
100%.
No, and this is without, like, you know, I was just doing some research before our call, and, you know, we still have 2 billion people on the planet with no internet access. 75% of the world population have no internet access.
Wouldn't that be amazing? I actually ran into somebody the other day who's a 24-year-old, you know, young man. He was doing some work for me here on my ranch, and I was like, "What's your cell phone number?" And he says, "I don't have a cell phone." I was like, "Well, what's your email address?" He goes, "I don't have a computer." And it just was like, where did this unicorn come from?
Did he have a fax machine?
Nope. He's like, "I'll give you my girlfriend's cell phone. If you need me, text her." I'm like, how cool in some ways would that just be that unplugged?
I live literally from where my house is. I have, I think, 3 one-room Amish schoolhouses within 2 miles from my house, right? So I really envy and kind of look at the Amish and how they operate and how they leverage technology and why they don't leverage certain technologies. From what I understand, you know, I'm not in the culture, I'm not, you know, raising it, I don't really fully understand. But from my understanding, a lot of why they do what they do with the horse and buggies versus the car and not using technology is around community, right? They want to be able to bring the community together. They want the community to support each other. And they believe that a lot of those digital things and newer technology kind of deviates and gets away from community and everybody helping each other. And I think there's certainly something to that.
Now, if you don't mind, one last, topic before we wrap it up. You know, we talked a lot about cyber warfare as the next frontier. What is the one thing, in your opinion, societies should start preparing for? I guess it's inevitable, right? Preparing for today, that most people are still the head in the sand, the storm will pass, and I don't have to deal with it now. The next generation will deal with it. But societies need to deal with this now.
Wait a minute, which society? Are you talking Western? You're talking the U.S.? Canada, you're talking Western Europe.
You can take a broad look at it, Wynn, or you can take a lot of
Asian countries, China, India. They're all culturally different. So I got to get back to where you got to pinpoint that question a little bit more.
So knowing that there's a difference between those societies and demographics and how they approach these topics, and some of them, to be honest with you, don't have enough technological advancement, and some of their population still not on the internet. And I'm pointing out to China, perhaps, some of their regions still not on the internet, India at the same time. But us here in a connected world, and I was back in my days, I was part of the, what's it called, the smart city connect competition that takes place around the world. And, you know, they compete how to connect these cities to the utmost level, from your parking meter to, you know, without park your car, you get charged, you don't have to present your credit card with all, and now I'm saying that to you guys, with all the risk that presents to everything else that you do in life. So, but these people, like right now, from our conversation, from a cognitive perspective, education, I'm assuming, should pop up to the top. If you can't change the laws, maybe the society should educate the kids going to school and maybe put a curriculum in, a part of the curriculum, maybe a class or two in school saying, this is perhaps something we should pay attention to.
Not a class or two. The principles should be built into all facets of education. A single class by itself, yeah, that's like once a year security awareness training. Take a look at what the Finns are doing. I think they're probably the leaders in, and I'm going to use the word cognitive education. It's probably the wrong word, but they are teaching cognitive resilience to 3-year-olds. How are they doing it? A lot of good videos out there on YouTube to look at it, but what they're doing is using existing teaching methods, fairy tales, reading, and all of that, and then doing deep dives with them at their level of understanding. Is that big bad monster really? Nah, he's just getting them to be able to parse some critical thinking at the ages of 2 and 3. Kids, magicians hate kids. Why? Because kids can see behind a lot of the crap that adults can't because of the biases that we've formed throughout our lives. Hate kids. So if the kids naturally have that, let's start early like the Finns are doing.
How about you, Mike?
Yeah, so I'll take a slightly different approach. I think of the cognitive Pearl Harbor and physical Pearl Harbors. I think with the state of the world, resiliency is key, right? The ability to take a punch and be able to get back up and stand and fight another round or fight another day. You know, looking at our critical infrastructure, our water, power, gas, telecommunications, transportation, those are all compromised and have been since at least 2014 in some spaces, some much longer than that. And I don't think we really realize that we are, you know, 3-4 minutes away from just absolute clusterfuck catastrophe globally. Right? Whether it's an attack here on the homeland, whether it's attack overseas, we see what's going on. We see the capability of some of these adversaries, not just cyber, but Shahed drones and kamikaze drones and all these other things. And I go back to what a lot more military leaders are saying is, you know, we used to be protected by the ocean to the east and the west, and we had friendlies to the north and the south. That is all flipped upside down. And if we don't think here in America that we could have another massive style 9/11, even more enhanced, that's buried with cognitive security. We call them polycrisis, right? Think of not just one thing. Think of multiple tiers of digital, cognitive cyber attacks, physical attacks, terrorists, hackers, criminal organizations. They're all working together right now. I mean, it's been documented. You can see it out there in certain national strategies and things. And that's one of my biggest takeaways. This is the stuff that keeps me up at night. How can we instantiate more resiliency, both in the individual and the cognitive level, but even in our homes that we live in, right? If the power grid goes down and the water gets tampered with, I mean, you're like 72 hours until most people would just not even be able to survive as a population. And I don't think that we are as prepared as a country and as a world for the realities of what humans can do to each other. And I think that's something we need to work on very, very quickly.
Thank you, Mike. Len? Hey,
I'm going to take, to go back to the Looney Tunes, I am going to be taking a severe exit stage left. This, you know, I agree with everything that both Mike and Wynn have said, but I'm going to go in a little bit of a different direction in my closing statement. I think that, you know, when we look at cognitive security, it is a factor of a much larger issue, and that is individual sovereignty in a hyper-connected world. You know, being able to not only secure our own minds, but our own place in this world as we're continuing to get overconnected, overstimulated, connecting everything to everything else. We have, I think, are losing our sovereignty and our value as individuals. I think that things like self-sovereign identity, trying to find a way to actually provide a secure private certificate or some way of individual validation for an individual human being, I think these are some of the other points that, you know, are definitely worth looking at. I think that, you know, eventually, I'm not going to lie, I'm kind of biased in this statement, but I think eventually everybody's going to be more like me, and it's not going to be out of choice, but out of necessity. So in the words of Star Trek, resistance is futile. You can either lead, follow, or get ran over, but the technology will not stop. But the key point we need to remain at the front of this discussion is, how do we maintain our own individualism? How do we maintain our own value? And how do we maintain our own sovereignty as individuals in this new connected reality?
As people become more like you, Len, and I'm saying this with total respect, while I would never do it, that's my choice, your choice is, when you map the transhumanism against the potential use and expansion of eugenics, suddenly you now have, hopefully now you can go down that road and tell us what's going to happen. Eugenics plus Len equals what?
Win 2.0.
I like that. Well, gentlemen, well, I want to thank
you. Come along for the ride, Win. You may not want to get implanted, but, you know, I need my own personal bodyguard, and you're it.
Jesus. I think it's time to go.
I didn't know Win is a bodyguard, so here you go. I'm learning something new now.
In the words of the Matrix, Win knows Kung Fu.
Well, I want to thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. That was a fascinating conversation. What stands out for me is cybersecurity no longer is about protecting the infrastructure, the network, or the data. It's still important, but the real shift is happening somewhere else, is a new frontier of the human cognition. And I hope this conversation that we've had today, it allows a little bit of an amplification, a little bit of an education for those who are listening, for those who will participate in this content eventually when I post it. And it adds a little bit to the awareness of what's going on, other than just blindly using technology without being aware of what's going on around them. And hopefully this helped a little bit. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for joining me again. Good to see
you. Can I throw one last thing, Robin? Can I throw one last thing?
Go ahead, Len. Go.
For anyone that's been listening, I would highly recommend it that you find these topics to be engaging. Check out Wynn's latest book, The Art and Science of Metawar. And for anybody that wants additional information around cognitive security, please take a look at the Cognitive Security Institute. Wynn, you want to give them the URL?
I'm not sure I have it in my head. Is it cognitivesecurityinstitute.org?
Org.
Is it?
Org. Org.
I mean, I have it on auto tab, so I don't have to think about it.
But yeah, the discussion doesn't end here. There's always something. And if you're interested, please, if you're either get involved, join with us, do some research. There's much more information available at cognitivesecurityinstitute.org.
And an incredible intellectual series of interdisciplinary resources. Some people are really, really three PhDs, and then there's some practitioners, and then there's some old rock and roll guys like me sitting around just throwing bullshit at them. But it's an incredible group of people that will engage with you.
Be there's prepared a lot of interesting for some spicy conversations.
And be prepared.
And I heard from somebody.
You know, I want to go back to one thing. One of the things that is causing so much of this is people are terrified to be wrong. And so many of us in science and engineering are terrified to be right. It's more like, what did we miss? There has to be something wrong with this. This works too well. And I'm always suspicious of when things work too well. Our educational system teaches us you must be right, you must be right, you must succeed. They don't extol the virtue of failure, because failure is where you learn. Success is where you get a bigger ego.
If you're going to fail forward.
That's right. That's right. Again, thank you, everybody, for joining me. I really appreciate it. For the audience, thanks so much for listening in. If you're coming on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you're coming on the podcast channels, thanks for listening in. I really appreciate it. And I'll see you guys at the next episode. Gentlemen, stick around for a second.